Well, good afternoon. This session is the Diversity, Equity, and Race, Broadening Perspectives in the Workplace session. Just want to make sure everybody thinks they're in the room they wish to be in. And we're looking forward to the conversation over the next hour. I am Mari McInnes. I am the Executive Vice President and Provost at UT Austin. And as is germane for this conference, I'm actually the first woman to hold that role at the University of Texas. So, and the conversation that we hope to engage in over the course of the next hour is one that I hope will help reframe how we all think about diversity in the workplace, where we want to talk about the value that those differences bring to our workplace, and how at the same time we can navigate and negotiate what are sometimes difficult moments that might arise when we are inviting diversity into the workplace, but how we grow from those multiple perspectives. Our three panelists today, I'm both moderator and panelist, all come from higher education. And while we realize that our audience probably isn't all themselves in that workplace, in that industry, it is a workplace like any other workplace. But one of the differences is we spend a lot of time researching ourselves, and we spend a lot of time researching these issues. And so there is much that we've learned. There is much information that comes from the tendency of the academy to constantly be looking at itself and asking questions about what works and what doesn't. And so there is much that we know about best practices. And it's also probably a place that all of you have spent some time, and certainly a place through which most of the American workforce will also pass at some point in their lives. And so higher education plays a really pivotal role as we think about the American economy. Our other panelists today are Sonsia Reagans-Lilly, who is the Vice President of Student Affairs and Dean of Students at the University of Texas at Austin. And Shetal Gupta, who is Associate Director of the Institute for Urban Policy Research and Analysis, and also an adjunct professor in the School of Social Work, also at the University of Texas at Austin. So I'm now going to switch from my moderator role or my introductor role over, and I'm going to go sit down with them, and we're going to start with some questions. So as has been mentioned many times throughout the course of the day, we find ourselves just past a historic election in America, an election in which there was lots of conversation around particularly two concepts, racism and sexism. And though that was discussed a lot and frequently, and though each one of us as an individual probably believes we know exactly what those words mean, I think it's really clear that not everybody in America is operating with the same definition of those terms. And so we're going to start our panel today by thinking a little bit about what those terms mean. And I'm going to start by asking Shetal to help us understand how it is that Americans might understand these terms differently. And one of the divides that I've noticed is that there, in many people's minds, seems to be a difference when you're thinking about, is somebody racist, right? Or was that an act of racism? The difference between intention and impact. And so, Shetal, I wonder if you can help us understand some of the ways in which, from a definition sense, we should understand these terms.
Sure. Thank you, Provost McGinnis. Thank you all for being here and for allowing this space to be able to have these tough conversations. Can you guys hear me? Okay. It's interesting that you ask about intent versus impact, because I have a quick story and then I'll get into the definitions. A few years ago, I was asked to give an interview at a TV station. And it was, the topic was pay equity or minimum wage, one of the two. And I remember going there, and it was one of my first times in Austin giving a TV interview. And so I walk in, and they tell me, okay, sit in the green room, and then when your segment is on, you know, we'll call you. We'll mic you up first, and then we'll call you. And I said, okay, sure. So I'm sitting there, and with me, next to me, is another Anglo-American gentleman. And so I'm waiting, and, you know, I'm in my suit attire, and he's in jeans and a polo shirt. And so the tech guy comes in with the mic, and he's like, all right, Dr. Gupta, we're going to mic you up. And he's like, all right, Dr. Gupta, please stand. And he walks over to the Anglo-American gentleman. And the gentleman goes, do I look like a Dr. Gupta to you? You know, we were the only two in the room. And so it was amazing because was he a racist? No. Was he a sexist? Probably not, that tech guy. His intent wasn't so, but the impact of invisibility was felt, most definitely. And so so to start that with, you know, in our elections, as we were talking about intent and impact, I want to get into the definition of racism and what that really means. And there are definitions out there, yes, I'm sure there are some that you work with, but just for the purposes of this conversation, one of the things that I wanted to bring in is that it is the it starts with the notion of privilege and looking at privilege. And privilege is the unearned advantage. And with that, the unearned advantage of a particular group. And so when you take racism, you're looking at differences by race. The superiority or inferiority of a racial group is really what I'd like to start with racism in. And with that, discrimination and prejudice come in. And so when the framework that I work from, and I know we're not getting academic, but is racism constitutes two elements, discrimination and prejudice. Prejudice is the thought process. You know, what are our attitudes and thoughts based on a stereotype? And then the discrimination, the act of. Acting in response to those stereotypes that we have. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes.
Does that make sense? Is there anything?
Makes sense. Yeah, makes that, sense.
Okay.
Yep, very good. So as we are thinking about these issues of racism and bias in the workplace, we need to pair that with conversations that many of us, hopefully all of us, are having in our workplace about the value of diversity and inclusion. And Sonsia, I wonder if you could talk to us some about your sense of the value of bringing diversity into the workplace.
Well, certainly. First of all, thank you all for coming. I am challenged to sit here because I was raised in a Southern Baptist church, and I want to get up and I want to walk back and forth and have a conversation with you. So if you see me squirming, that's why. My tendency is to get up. Also, I am accustomed to working with youth. And so when something is said, I'm accustomed to hearing this. So as we go throughout our presentation today, I will find great comfort, in receiving that affirmation from those of you in the room as we are talking about very difficult, very challenging topics, and certainly post-election, those that are at the forefront of our minds and certainly showing up in the workplace in many different ways. So when we talk about the importance of diversity in education or in the workplace, diversity is important and critical as it relates to learning and how we learn and how we all become global citizens. And that's truly the desire, certainly from a higher education perspective, but as I work with our staff, faculty on campus, it's important that we are all engaged in learning. And the fundamental premise of learning is learning from others and learning from differences and learning to respect those. And that is at the core of why diversity is certainly important. And we can talk about, from many different standpoints, what the Supreme Court has said, what others say on a regular basis in terms of the importance and really substantiating diversity and almost feeling as if we have to prove it, we have to give it merit. But at a very, very fundamental place of understanding, diversity is so important if we all want to continue learning. And if we truly intend to be global citizens, we have to learn from each other. The demographics certainly tell us that we are shifting in terms of who we are as a nation, and we are in our parents, our partners, our offspring, they are all certainly going to interact on a regular basis with those that are different. And that can fall among many different lines. So I talk about diversity from the standpoint of global diversity and global or broad diversity. Since I've already used global citizen, I'll use broad diversity. So it is age, it is gender, it is language, it is certainly race. There are so many different ways. It's ability level. And so there are so many reasons and so many ways that we are all different. And that is something to be celebrated. That is something that contributes to the quality of our interactions and our relationships.
Can I add something to that, if that's okay, just to talk about quality of our relationships? One of the things as I was prepping for this panel that really drove home to me the importance of diversity and inclusion is Forbes talked about in December of last year of how diversity and inclusion are going to be the terms for 2016. And really they have been, and looked at diversity as the driver of innovation when it comes to the workplace. And that innovation is just as important because it's not enough just to get people from different backgrounds in a room. That's a great first step, but the quality piece is that you ensure that those differences are supported, and that they are held to a high standard, and that, you know, they feel valued. Those that are from different backgrounds feel valued. So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. And so one of the things that we often read in the literature about diversity in the workplace is it sometimes leads to tension in the workplace. It sometimes leads to difficult situations. And I wonder, Sonsia, if you can speak a little bit to some of the strategies that you've developed for working with very diverse teams where that sometimes leads to conflict or tension.
So I'm going to start with a story. Thank you, Mark. Great question. There isn't a day that I have the privilege to wake up and not address, not realize how gender and how race play a role in everything that I do. From sending my son and daughter out of the house, to facilitating a meeting, to sending an email. So fundamentally, again, race, diversity, are just so prominent in our world. And others, many others, and so getting to the question, can wake up and not think about those things. So as I am interacting on a daily basis, certainly right now, but on a regular basis with difference and diversity and inclusion and having those conversations, conflict is inevitable and it's in this space. And there is healthy conflict. And actually going back to Forbes and some of the other articles written of late, they speak to the importance of conflict and creativity and innovation. They go hand in hand. So conflict in and of itself is not something to avoid or to run away from. So in terms of strategies, number one, without being very elementary about ground rules, but incorporating so everyone in that space understands that conflict is inevitable and that conflict is healthy, and this is how we properly respond and engage that conflict with the understanding that we're going to come on the other side of it with an output. And so going into spaces, being very clear about conflict and being sophisticated in a way to talk about it so that you aren't calling it out as a negative. So that's another strategy. You want to talk about it as something that's constructive. You want to talk about it as something that is healthy and a natural part of the process to reach understanding and to reach respect and to reach. So those are a couple strategies. Also, making sure that everyone has a voice at the table, getting back to that point of value. So everyone has to feel that in whatever way they communicate, that they are going to be heard, and it is going to be valuable, and it is going to be acknowledged as such. And so creating healthy environments is something that I talk about all the time. And so creating a culture, number one, so that conflict is welcome. So you have to start there, another strategy. And how do you create that culture? It's by creating healthy environments. And what does a healthy environment look like in your organization, your entity, your agency, so that conflict, tension, is something that is a regular part of the discourse, and it is also healthy. So you're not raising your voice. You're not interrupting. You're not dismissing yourself and walking away from the conversation. You do have your opportunity to speak in your turn, to be heard, and that all of the conversation is mission central. We're all going to a certain place. So we can articulate what we need to say, but it is mission central, and we're going towards that desired outcome.
So each of us, as women in American higher education, walk into a lot of rooms where we're the only woman. Both of you walk into rooms where you're the only person of color. And I'd like to ask each of you to reflect a moment on some of your strategies for being in those situations that are then sometimes accompanied by maybe somebody overlooking you, somebody not taking your point seriously. You're at a meeting, you make a point, you go around, you know, and it gets ignored. 10 minutes later, a guy stands, says the exact same thing, and suddenly that's a brilliant idea. You know, what are some of your strategies for adjusting in a workplace where you're often the only?
Very overprepared. I generally come in, I try to come in very overprepared. And I've come to realize of late that it is okay to not be, in terms of my voice is important, and it has taken working with Vice President Lilly and other women that I have looked to for allies to know that. And I think that's the second point, which is having allies. Having other women of color that are in positions of leadership and asking for guidance. And I do now speak up when I just recently was in a situation where I had been saying something that we should be doing with our institute for the last 6 months, and all of a sudden, you know, a male comes in and says, "I think we should." And I was like, "Oh, like I've been saying for the last 6 months." You know, like I was trying to be funny about it, but I was also trying to make a point, which is that that was my idea, you know, and I wanted to make sure that that was acknowledged. Also, that trying to break the myths in my own head. There is this rhetoric about pay equity that women just don't ask for salary increases or they're not good negotiators. Women are fantastic negotiators. I mean, you should see us with our kids, right? I mean, we can do it, you know? We negotiate on behalf of others that are, you know, that we are trying to advocate for, this, that, and the other. We're fantastic negotiators. And so to know that the research backs it up and to know it in my own head. And so when I walk in, you know, a year after year, and for my evaluation, to not be afraid to ask. So it's getting over my own fears.
So excellent. Being prepared, key. Also going in anticipating, and I don't mean that from the standpoint of being paranoid or pessimistic about a particular environment, but as I shared, I wake up every day looking in the mirror at the way I present. So I somewhat anticipate that it's likely that I'll be the only. And self-talks, number two, just, you know, it's okay. I stand on the shoulder of giants, and they were the only. And to recognize those feelings and to own those feelings, but to make sure that those feelings don't get in the way of me speaking up. So number two, it's even something as practical as choosing where I'm going to sit in the room. I can choose to sit in the back of the room, and that's symbolic and sends a message, or I can choose to sit front and center. I can sit to the right or to the left, or I can choose to sit far, you know, to the right. So making very conscious decisions about how you want to show up in that space. I also think it's important that when we speak, we have something to say. So making sure that the anxiety of being the only doesn't drive you to feel you need to say something, but say something when you truly have something to say, and to also not beat ourselves up, not overly criticize who we are in a particular space. And I think we have a tendency to do that. So to go in and, you know, I always say powerful people, they do what they do and it's over. So you don't, you know, lament and continue to beat yourself up with negative self-talk, but know that you belong in that space. And if you didn't, you would not have been invited. So a lot of self-talk in that space. Another, I know we move on to another question, we'll need to do that, but another is to make sure that among your pool of mentors are those, in my case, white males. Mm-hmm. I have solid relationships with white males so that I can go and say, okay, so I know you probably don't realize this, but I want you to observe this next week. And when we're in that room, in that space, what do you see? And am I off center, or are you acknowledging? And 9 times out of 10, they will acknowledge, and they will also acknowledge they've never recognized that before. And now you have an advocate in that space like you've never had before, because they are then allies. They're paying attention to the dynamics in the room. But be mindful of your nonverbals, because those invisible messages speak volumes, and also pay attention to those messages that are in the room. For instance, the eye contact, I make sure to give it, and typically that means that I want it back. Because I'm looking at you, I'm valuing you, I'm acknowledging you, and so that means something to me. So set your own tone in the room.
Those are great points, and you've both spoken to the importance of allies. And I think it's a really important thing for all of us to be thinking about, is sort of building your network, building your board of directors.
That's right.
And your board of directors should actually be diverse itself, for the many different reasons that you were referring to, right? Because there is great value to be gained from so many different ways. Having a member of your board of directors who actually is in a position of power in your company, in your workplace, can be enormously helpful, because once they really get to know you and know what you're capable of, they'll often be the person who can be your sponsor for the opportunities to rise in that organization. They can also help you interpret certain situations that indeed may have a very particular gendered or cultural meaning that if you're not on the inside of the group, you may not get. And they can serve important roles as an interpreter as well. And for many of us, if we were to build our board of directors only of people who look like us, we may not have many options in our workplace. So it's really important that you think about building your board of directors, and that you rely on those people, you lean on those people. They're there to be your advocates, they're there to be your interpreters, they're there to be your supporters, and they can really make an enormous difference. I certainly have relied on mine, and unfortunately, I will say the vast majority of my board of directors are men, because in higher education, there are not that many women in leadership roles. Now, one of the things I will say that attracted me to the University of Texas is how many women there were in major leadership roles. 5 deans of the 18 colleges, Lily as vice president of student affairs. It was an extraordinary range of women in powerful positions, but that's not always true. But it sometimes tells you a lot about the character of a place, mm-hmm. and whether it's a place you wish to be building your work life. And so that's another thing you can keep an eye to. You know, what does the diversity of the leadership look like at your own workplace, and is it somewhere you wish to be? So as we think about some of the challenges that we face in the workforce, either as women or as people of color, what are some of the things that you think are some of the key challenges that we need to be mindful of?
One of the things that comes to my mind in terms of challenges is what we talked about earlier, which was the biases. Mm-hmm. How do you confront not only our own, but other biases that are in the room, or how do you manage them? As a woman of color, how do I work to manage that when I walk into a room? And from my particular standpoint of being a leadership role in a policy institute, how do I work my role of working with students of color on campus and to help develop and create policies where students of color are at the center of that policy in order to help them feel safer on campus or this, that, and the other. So that's a challenge that I myself face just within the work that I do. And turn it over.
So one of the greatest challenges for me as a supervisor is working with you. So it's working with women. Oftentimes, women come into a space, and if you are a supervisor and they are reporting to you, they are establishing their own sense of who you are and who you are not, who you stand for, but what you stand for. So oftentimes in this multiple institutions, major research one institutions, I find that I have to have lunch and breakfast and coffee with my female colleagues so that we can establish a rapport, we can establish an understanding. I don't find the same when I'm reporting to, but it's when I have staff that are reporting to me that are female, and that does not fall among a particular demographic. But there seems to be, and so I own it because I'm the common denominator, but knowing your own impact, knowing how you show up in a space, and for some reason that has been a common denominator, and I always and regularly offer the females, particularly those that are direct reports, to lunch or to coffee so that we begin on the right foot to have a general understanding of principles and ways in which we work together. And you do it in a very sophisticated way. So I don't say, hi, let's go out to lunch because I have this past or this history and I want to make sure. But just I am on my listening and learning tour and want to get to know you better. And just being self-aware and what you bring to the environment and what you bring to that conversation. And ever since I have implemented that practice, it has been a significant change and an improvement. So that's a challenge in the workplace that I've managed in a creative way. But knowing how you show up in that space and being open to feedback and learning and growing.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the concrete tips, some of the real takeaways that we can provide to the audience related to some of the best practices for helping to create a healthy environment that really values diversity and inclusion in the workplace. And I wonder if each of you could share a couple of the things that you think are real takeaway tips.
I'll start with one and then we'll rotate.
Okay.
One is to show up and be true to who you are. The fact that I show up and I bring the diversity that I bring to the organization provides a unique opportunity for others that work with me. So I don't try to conform. I don't try to be anyone other than who I am. I am not driven. My behavior, my actions aren't driven by a title. It's driven on individual respect and showing up and being who I am all the time.
Yeah, I think authenticity is very important. Another best practice that I have...
I got one, yeah. So I'll take it.
Another best practice has been to... for me, I talked earlier about over-prepared. If I feel that there is a challenge at work with myself and a male colleague or just any colleague, and it comes down to one of my internal processes is being a woman of color in a leadership position, there is a challenge that for that person, do I actually belong here? And so just showing up doing my homework ahead of time. If there's a challenge and I've made a decision on it as to why I made that decision, I give facts, I give evidence, and I back that up to just say, here's why, here's what the numbers show, here's why I've decided this, and to know that my decision ultimately lies to improve the Institute.
Talk about race, just coming back to the topic of this session. Don't shy away from the discussion about race and your own experiences. Don't shy away from questions. If you aren't of color, ask questions. That being authentic, learning is so important. So be open and honest and willing to dialogue about difference and about change. And that goes back to the healthy environment. But one tip is to ask me questions about why I do. I regularly have questions about my hair, you know, in terms of, you know, for instance, it was a protest post-election and it was raining. And I walked out with a colleague, and she happened to be white. We walked out and she stopped at the overpass. And I said, I'm going to continue to go out. And she said, but your hair. And I said, yes, the students are going to see me in a different way. It's going to curl up, it's going to frizz up, but the work's more important than my hair right now. And so she stayed back. But, you know, the fact that she said that, the fact that there was this genuine and you know, curiosity about our hair as an African-American woman. So I am so prepared to always talk to people about, no, it's natural, but I flat iron it. Oh, no, I don't have to do that. No, I use the same products. You can use my flat iron. I can use your flat iron. It's just a part of who we are, and it goes to being authentic. But when people are honest and open, it creates that healthy exchange. So that's a very simple example of late, but just, you know, ask questions, be who you are, share who you are, and...
If I can add one more to that one, is that one of the things that, again, my lens is policy. And in the session before, when we're talking about bias, China had said, she said, you know, a white woman comes to the table and she has these 12 things. When you're a woman of color, you have 16. I think she said 14, but you have more. And so that point hit so beautifully, because what I work towards in terms of best practices is to develop the policies, including of the 16 things, not the 12, and then let's try to add a few here and there. No, we start at the 16, because when you can develop a policy or a practice for your institute or your workplace that's inclusive of all 16, then you've just raised all women up. You know, and so that's one of the challenges, but it's one of the best practices. I know it's a best practice, and we will, yeah, and that's one of the things that we're trying to do.
And so one of the things that you can all do in your companies and in your workplaces is think hard about your policies and advocate for either changes or additions. Quite often it's silences as much as anything else. And sometimes it can be fairly minor interventions. It can be the creation of an official sort of mentoring program. So one of the things that happens quite often is, you know, if your workplace is dominated by white men, they can be very chummy with each other, they give each other advice, and it happens very organically that they're given the kind of mentorship that is needed in order for them to succeed in the workplace. And quite often, women or people of color just aren't talked to in the same way. And so without an official program, sometimes really important information about the way company culture works is just not shared. But if a company has an official mentoring program, and you have the kinds of people who are advocates and allies who are in that, who really want to see everybody succeed, who really understand the importance of diversity in the workplace, that can make an enormous difference. One of the most important things you can do is examine how hiring works. So one of the things that we know from all the research is that if you put out a job ad, and the tendency in job ads is to bullet point, kind of list every aspect, every characteristic of a job candidate that you'd love to see, And these things become laundry lists. No individual has all these things. So imagine there are 12 things in this list, and a woman or a person of color looks at this list, and they'll count, and let's say there are 12 things there, and they've only got 6, and they'll say, well, then I'm not qualified for this job, and they won't even apply, right? But a lot of men will look at this, and they've got 2, and they'll go, I got this, right? I'm going to get this job, right? There's just a completely different approach that we all come to the workplace with. And if you can very consciously change some of those things so that your jobs no longer list the 12 things you want in a candidate, but instead put the 2 or 3 things that are essential and then say other things that might be nice, right? Other preferences, or it would be, we would be interested in candidates who might have. That changes it completely, and even just the diversity of your pool changes. If you set up criteria by which you evaluate your candidates by a very specific list of characteristics you're looking for, so that you're not just hiring people on gut, right? A lot of people like to hire on gut, and when you hire on gut, you tend to hire people whose lives map your own, right? They're interested in the same physical activities. They've gone to the same kinds of schools. They've had the same kind of life trajectory. So setting up those kinds of objectives. So those kinds of policy things, it can sound sometimes like a wonkish solution, right? But they're actually the things that give structure to allow the value of diversity and inclusion to really flourish in a workplace setting. So for each of you, I'd be interested to hear, since you moved into the workplace, what in your career were you not prepared for?
If I can be brutally honest, you guys, this is the provost of my university, and this is the vice president. I'm not stressed at all.
We create environment.
Safe place.
No, yeah, very safe. I think this is my first leadership, official leadership role. And coming into it, once I got into it, I think I was surprised by how many people are trying to pull you down. If I can just be honest, and that felt like I didn't belong there, and that it should have been under this male candidate, or it should have been this male candidate. And so that was the hardest thing for me to swallow, and it was a year in, and I think I told my husband that I think I'm done. And I told my father, this is it. I can't take the time away. This is too much. And my father was like, you aren't going down without a fight. You know, he's like, I didn't raise you here to go down without a fight. But he didn't mean like outwardly. He just meant you are more than qualified to be here, you know. And so show up, like Vice President Lilly was saying, just show up. And but that was one of the challenges I had to, my internal struggles, and know that I was exactly qualified to be where I was.
So I have to tell a little story, short story. I was born and raised in California, and my parents are both from Texas, met in California, and so we were raised there. My mother was in Texas during a time that the University of Texas was segregated, so she couldn't come back, couldn't attend. She went to HD, great education, all is well. However, it was very redemptive for me to be at the University of Texas at Austin. So I am the dean of students, you know, first African-American woman to serve in that capacity. I had very short, natural hair, and I wore a suit during my interview. So I am so motivated to be here. I'm just excited about the work, getting to really connect with the Texas culture. And the feedback I received early on was that I wore a pantsuit and not a dress to my interview. So that was official kind of feedback that I received. I also received feedback that my hair, the way that I was wearing my hair short and curly, was intimidating to some. And so I was surprised by the state of affairs in Texas. So California is very liberal, very progressive in many ways. And so that can be argued. But for this conversation. And so coming from a place that those topics, those characteristics were never mentioned, I was surprised by that. And it was then reinforced when I would meet with parents or other members of the community, and they would wait for the dean. And I would say, she's here. You know, and just watch their reaction. So the intersectionality in terms of gender and also my race, but also where I wasn't prepared for Texas in terms of it being conservative, some might say. I can't quite say that it was just that, but the lack of preparation for the community to receive. Then I moved it to Westlake. So, you know, just I wasn't prepared for the dynamics of integrating into a community that wasn't as progressive as the communities in California. So it was a real wake-up call for me moving from one state to another state.
Yeah. So it is, we've got about 15 minutes left. And we have time for audience questions. It looks like we have two mics in this middle aisle. Can I just get a sense, are they going, can I get a show of hands or maybe some snaps? Do we have some people who would like to go to the mic and ask questions? Okay, good. So let's start moving towards the mics. And we will kind of alternate back and forth between the front mic and the back mic. And since you're already there, I'll let you get us started off while everybody else is lining up at the front mic.
Okay. So my name is Morgan, and I work for the Spurs. But I just had a question. I just recently, well, about almost a year, graduated from Baylor University. And I just had a question since you all were in higher ed. And basically, for anyone who doesn't know the acronym PWI, PWI means like a predominantly white institution. That's what Baylor is, and we've that's what Baylor is. And I just had a question as far as like a student, how do we get to voice our cultural like issues with our, I guess, like anybody higher up in the university? How do we get that diversity and inclusion to the university? Because recently, even when I was there, we had issues as far as like my brother was there and Obama was elected, they hung nooses from the trees. And just recently, one of my friends, her younger sister is there, and her friend got pushed off of our sidewalk when Trump won and got told that they aren't allowed on the sidewalks anymore. Right. And they've been targeting women of color, black right. women, Hispanic women,
right.
Muslim women. Like they've been attacking women of color. So how do we get that diversity and inclusion to our universities without things like that having to happen before they make a change?
Right. So, and I know many at your university, at Baylor, and the doors are open. It's the courage to go in and knock and say, I need to be heard. This is what's happening, and you need to know about it. They're the Office of the Dean of Students. You have your Vice President for Student Affairs. You have your Provost's Office. But for the most part, they will come through the Dean of Students' Office. But we also have college representatives. So our job is to make sure that you have opportunity and that you're building those relationships so that you have voice. And we are regularly asking the question and sensing the pulse. So you have a voice. Use it. You also have your student government associations. But no one can tell your story the way that you can tell your story. We have, and our president is very open, interested, and committed. So he wants to hear and hear directly from students, as does our provost. So we have the students coming in and meeting regularly with different administrators, but our president as well, so that he is hearing from students of color, particularly Latino students, our African American students, our veteran students, our transfer students, our international, our undocumented. And he is listening and hearing, and we are taking copious notes because we want to, of course, have a campus culture and a campus environment so that everyone feels safe and welcome. So knock on the door, set an appointment, and leave a note. Okay?
And if I can add also, group together, like get students together and strategize in terms of if I am not in these leadership positions, but I am, I work in Black Studies. And so how do you work with faculty that represent, that you feel like is an ally represent you? And then how can you then create that dialogue, you know, with those that are in leadership positions?
Yeah.
Question.
Question from the back.
Hi. I'm not as articulate as I'd like to be today because it's just, I feel very emotional in here. This is in the workplace, but also just in the country right now. The struggle of being open and diverse and inclusive when it feels like you're having to step in to listen to something that is really feels hateful or feels just sort of against. And so I think just trying to understand, I grew up in Michigan. And so talking to people there now who are like, gosh, what happened? Again, I don't want to assume similar feelings to anybody else in the room. I'm just speaking for myself. It's like, well, I don't have the luxury of voting on social issues right now because I can't put food on the table. And so it was like challenging my privilege, which I accept, of sort of not having the same financial struggle and having it as a luxury to sort of feel and vote and index higher on things about equality. And so just in kind of, I know I'm asking a really broad question, I'm just wondering like how, what advice do you have to sort of help kind of keep listening, but also sort of, I don't want to be inclusive of intolerance. So I'm struggling with sort of how to stay in the game, but also not sort of act like that, not be the, have that be okay either. And so I don't know. I'm just kind of an open wound, and I'm just wondering like how anyone in this room, or you know, you from the wonderful experiences that you've shared today, how are you handling that? Just as a in the workplace or anywhere, because I'm really struggling, and I know I'm not alone in that struggle. So.
Yeah. You are not at all alone in this struggle. I think it is a struggle that many in the nation are having at the moment. And I don't know that I have the answer. I do know that one answer is to stay in it. And in some ways, the conversation you were talking about with your friends in Michigan is an important one for all of us to hear. I think it is important for national healing, which President Obama is calling for all of us to do, for us to try to listen and understand whichever side you're on, the other side, and not start by making assumptions of the motivations of the other side. And I do hope, and I'm trying very much to be a very optimistic person, and I do tend to be, I do hope that we, through continued dialogue, that we will actually make progress. Sometimes points of real conflict and real tension and moments that seem really dire, sometimes out of that can come real progress. And so my thought is we keep talking.
Yeah, keep talking. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I wanted to give anyone else. And I'm sorry, that was such a great question that I've completely lost my train of thought or thing. But I think that, so one of the things I struggle with when you were talking at the very beginning about racism has the kind of two components, right? The thought component and the action component. And so when I engage with people in conversations about privilege and racism, I think it's really easy for people to understand the action component. And because they understand that, they say, I'm not racist. Because I would never do that. I would never not hire someone or treat someone that way or do some of the things that you're seeing in the news right now. And what's harder to get into is the thought component and some of those things that maybe you don't act on, but you're still thinking about. And so I just would welcome any words of advice you have and how to engage that part of the conversation.
I would say, first off, the most important thing is to engage yourself in that conversation. In terms of if we ourselves are aware that we have these same implicit biases, and how do we create our own awareness for ourselves? And then how is it that we have the conversations and build the knowledge to kind of mitigate or manage those biases? And in the same way with others. You know, prejudice, the thought process, knowledge is its counter. with discrimination, it's policies that promote equality. So really is that bringing that knowledge to the table that this does exist, we all have them, and validating that, normalizing that. Now that we know we have them, let's be aware in all moments and in all processes. I started earlier talking about intent versus impact. This is one of those avenues your question probably can, I can hopefully bring it to your question, which is that oftentimes we engage in the communication in a workforce or in your work environment, and you're like, well, you hear so-and-so felt that way. Well, that wasn't my intent. That's not what I was trying to do, you know. But the onus is actually to make sure that the impact is validated over the intent. So even if your intent wasn't that, we have to focus on the impact. And so if we can focus on the impact of potentially if we say something this way, okay, what's that impact going to be? Or if you hear that, okay, this was impacted, that, okay, let's go work on that. Does that, the starting point is impact when it comes to communication. Does that help? Does that make sense? So awareness of the biases, normalizing that we all have them, and then work from there. And then intent versus impact, start with the impact and how that's going to. Does that help?
Okay. And I'll just add, we also have to recognize that everyone isn't ready to have the type of conversation we're ready to have, right? And if we don't feel skilled in having that conversation, then we frustrate ourselves. So in addition to knowing more about your own intercultural competency and your own bias, it may not be a conversation that you should have. So know when to say, I'm unable to continue in this dialogue because you're coming from this place of almost, to a sense, this real surface conversation in terms of, but I don't act like that, I don't behave like that, but the deeper level, the next layer, is related to your thought process and your own implicit bias. So know when to walk away from those conversations. I think we put ourselves in places, and because we're so committed, but oftentimes, know when to say, and know when to walk away, right? Know when to say, hold on.
Question in the back.
My question may have already been answered, so if you feel that it has, let me know. In the workplace, in the world, white fragility and male fragility are real things, and the internet talks about them a lot, and white tears and male tears. When you are in a space, in the workplace in particular, where you have an idea and it does not get heard, and then 6 months later someone else of a more privileged group, a white dude, has that same idea. So it can be very challenging, and it can feel unsafe sometimes in the workspace to confront people's fragility and the fact that having direct conversations, meaningful conversations about their bias, fall on deaf ears. So not that it is your job to tell us how to fix the world, but are there specific strategies that you can elaborate on in terms of where people feel fragile and where people get really defensive because you are challenging them and maybe calling them explicitly or not racist or sexist or misogynist?
Yeah, it's a tough one, and obviously it varies so much by the individual you're dealing with, and hopefully you know them well enough to know how to approach it. Sometimes questions are very useful, ways of asking questions that don't seem that you're challenging them as much, but that in your question you're actually pointing out the place in which, the moment in which they've been one of those things that you've listed. And sometimes questions can be a more gentle way to go about it. That's one possible approach.
And to your point, one of my favorite classic questions is, help me understand.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're not being confrontational, right. You're not calling them anything, because we don't want to label. That's what we're fighting against, right? So we don't want to put people in boxes either. So how, help me understand, when this was described earlier, it seemed, but help me understand the difference between what we're talking about now and what we were talking about earlier. Where did the differences lie?
right? So you can approach it in a way that calls it out. Sometimes it's humor. You just call it out, you know, but you have to know your environment because context matters always. And other times it's saying, I just said that. And I know you all heard me.
Yeah.
You know, it context matters.
And you have to know yourself. Right? Mm-hmm. You have to do the things that you are comfortable with.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Question up front.
Hi. I'm actually a student at UT right now. And I know that, especially in the aftermath of the election and the protest on campus, a lot of students on campus kind of feel a little iffy about like the situation. And my question is that considering UT and student government and Senate are academic organizations that can't really take strong political stands, how do you reach out to the students who feel like simply creating dialogue between like different parties isn't really doing enough to address the needs of like diverse people, especially women of color, women of color on campus?
So we encourage the students to for these ideas to bubble and to emerge from the student population, however, we have 1,300 student organizations, and they identify and label how they affiliate with the institution. They can be academic, they can be social, they can be political. And so when students want to organize, they're encouraged to do so, and they begin with that database. So if they ask us to assist them, we will make sure time, place, and manner, but usually it emerges from student initiatives and student desire. We have organizations on campus, as you know, just a couple weeks ago, a pretty intense debate between opposing views. And that's one of the themes. And we all, it's another tip, learn from the opposition. You have to listen and you have to learn. There are channels on television that I watch that are on in my house on a regular because I have to know how they think. So, does that answer your question?
Question in the back.
Hi. I'm 20 years into my profession. I work for one of the major tech companies, locally. And of course, it's a very white, male-dominated industry. And as a biracial woman, I'm half black and half Hispanic. A lot of times I find myself as the only, not only woman in the room, but, you know, a woman of color. And I just still struggle, and I get so frustrated with myself because there'll be the occasional disparaging remark. I can think of a few on the top of my head, you know, calling Obama, you know, monkey or when the Trayvon trial was happening, I had a manager that called him a, and I don't want to get emotional, but he called him a thug in a hoodie who was at the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, I'm frustrated because I don't, even though I'm 20 years into my career, I still struggle with how to diplomatically respond in that moment. Mm-hmm. And I could use some ideas on how to do so.
Those are extremely tough. And sometimes there's the moment, and sometimes there's the moment after. So in a large group situation, some people can, if you correct them in that moment, can be enormously defensive in a way that you may not actually change any of the behavior down the road. But sometimes you can have a conversation with a colleague afterwards, and this is, you know, not everybody's receptive to it, I know that. But some are, if you say something along the lines of, I want to know if can I share some feedback with you? When you said X, that made me really uncomfortable. And I wonder if we could talk about that. And quite often in a unthreatening sort of situation and where that individual's not being embarrassed in front of others, sometimes you can find a greater receptivity to a conversation about a really difficult subject.
And sometimes I'll say, we really need to talk. And I'll, not at that moment, but I call attention to the fact that I'm not okay with what you just said. Other times, as Dr. McGinnis said, you just say, you know, I'd like to share that feedback. Other times you say, I can't believe what you just said. You know.
Is it ever okay to check them
at that moment?
I wouldn't check them at that okay, moment because it can be counterproductive.
And I never do it, but at the same time, you know, I just don't know how to be. It's either I'm passive about it or I would go there, and I don't want to have to go there.
Yeah. But professionally, in a professional environment, your definition of go there, I mean, there could be go there. And then there is just to correct it. But if yours is emotional and it is going to fare poorly on you from a behavioral standpoint, I would not go there. I would simply say, can we talk later? Or I really need to talk to you about that statement. Or follow up later. But definitely, in my mind, don't let it go unaddressed.
Thank you. Yeah. Up front. And we're and front. These last two questions, then our time is up.
Okay. So I love these conferences and things because we learn a lot about leadership and we get a lot of leadership tips, especially as a woman. We are taught and we learn more about speaking up and you know, having that internal fortitude. My question is, how do you reconcile all those great things that you learn with stereotypes that prevail, especially me being a black woman? You know, we have heard the angry black female. Everybody knows it. And I have the benefit of having grown up in Kentucky, very genteel Southern. It comes out a lot, especially when I'm talking a lot. But postgraduate, I went to Washington, D.C., and that's where, where I first hit the, you know, career world. And then I moved to Texas. And so I'm very outspoken, and I wear a lot of colors. And the first time I had a kind of, you know, interaction that wasn't so positive, and I took some of those leadership things and said, let's talk. Why are we having this kind of, you know, friction? And the first thing was, well, right now I feel intimidated by you. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that I was, you know, I'm coming to you, and I'm talking to you, and I'm not yelling, and I know I'm a larger than average size, but I mean, you know, I thought that I was approaching it with all those tools that we're given, you know, to speak up and stand, you know, and ask those questions, and it was just kind of flatlined, and it really did set me back a little bit, and that's something that I've been actively working on. So, you know, I'm sure that you've come across this, and so I just wanted to know, what kinds of things do you do, or how do you balance that act of being, you know, heard and you know, dodging that angry black female stereotype?
So, number one, it was a wonderful learning experience for you in terms of your own self-awareness and how others might perceive you. Number two, I wouldn't let that one exchange stop me from using all of the leadership skills and moving forward in the same way with a different person, because context matters. Number three, I would continue to do exactly what you do. And if someone is feeling intimidated, then bring someone else into the room, but it doesn't stop the conversation. So I always say that I'm not going to let others control me. I'm going to be in charge of me, and that being authentic, right? So you still have your conversation. If you need, you can encourage them, bring someone else into the room so that you don't feel that way. Because I'm not doing that to you. You're doing that to yourself. And right. We need to have this conversation.
Right.
And continue with the conversation. That's, don't own their stuff, quote unquote, right? That's theirs.
And our last question to end us today.
Okay, drum roll. And I will say that my question has changed about five times since standing in this line. And you've given us lots of good tips on how to deal with these situations in the workplace. And I work in a high-tech company where, yeah, I'm the minority with the people that I work with. But it's the holidays. So my son's married a girl who's Muslim. My other son has married a girl who's from a socialist European country. And my daughter's married a guy who's Jewish. We're all getting together for Christmas. So now we don't really have a hard time discussing things and talking about things. But through the current events, there's some really distressful feelings. My one son's, his in-laws' bags are packed and they're ready to go because they think they're ready to be deported. Mm-hmm. You know, again, we're meeting with friends of ours who are from another country, and they're worried about being deported. So if you want to have those conversations and you see it's not going well, how do you draw back when you're sitting at the table? Because it's not the same as, like, you can go to somebody's office the next day. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, many of us probably have had experience with this, and there are no real good answers for this one, other than I have found I have many in my family that do not exactly share all of my political beliefs. And so there are some things I know not to talk about and not to touch. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a sad thing because you like to be able to be completely open with your family. But I've also noticed that people can say things that are hurtful and that last for a really long time. You're going to have to figure out in the dynamics of your own family what works and how far and what topics you really want to be, you know, addressing as a large group. Sometimes they're safer in smaller settings.
Yep.
The holidays are actually also often accompanied by alcohol, and that tends to make things worse if there are really heated things about which people disagree. Mm-hmm. And keeping it focused on the things that really are deeply shared values
yep.
that family have. You know, there is tons to talk about family and what's going on in everybody's lives and so forth. So quite often, those are much safer territory. And if all else fails, there's always the weather.
If I can put on my social work hat, since my I'm a social worker by trade and was a clinician for some time, if you choose, Provost McGinns was right, you know, in terms of there are some topics that maybe you just don't approach in this moment if the safety is not there. But if you do decide to approach it, I think acknowledging feelings and validating feelings, I mean, that's just the basic in terms of these hard conversations. And then sometimes acknowledging, God, this is hard, you know, and I don't know how to move forward. You know, how do we stay here as a family and move forward? What do you guys feel? You know, so it's just the acknowledging and validating and just being real in terms of where you are. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everybody so much for coming this afternoon for a great conversation. I want to thank the panelists who gave us a lot to think about today. Enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you all for being here.